You know, there are certain dates that everyone should remember. Like, for example, your partner's birthday is a good example of that. Or the fact that tomorrow is April 15th, which is tax day. And I'm not going to lie, with all of the talk that's been going on the last couple of weeks about the solar eclipse and the earthquakes and all of the conversations and conspiracy theories about it being the end of the world, I'm kind of surprised that no one tried to tie April 15th to the start of the tribulation. And because I can't think of anything more trialing than that, realistically. But in all seriousness, another date that I believe Pastor Philip will remember forever is April 7th, last Sunday. For those of you that didn't hear, last Sunday after service, Pastor Philip went on a bicycle ride, and he was in a pretty nasty bicycle accident. He had to be rushed to the hospital, and while, honestly, the x-rays and everything came back pretty good, and he was wearing a helmet, so it prevented a lot of the other injuries, he was diagnosed with a concussion. And so, because here at the venues we believe in science, we're listening to what the doctors say, and they told him to stay away from bright lights and computers and stress. And so he is recovering well, but that's where he is today. And I know that he was pretty bummed about it, actually, because not only was he looking forward to being here with you all and seeing everybody, but we're continuing in our series called Stuff You Can't Say in Church. And today we're going to be talking about cussing. And I know that with like 30 years of Baptist pastor like pent up inside of him, he was looking forward to just unveiling all of the cuss words that he knows on everyone today and to do that freely. Monday, November 30th, 2009 is another date that I will always remember. And my debate students who I was coaching at the time will also forever remember this date. You know that back then, we used to have this one practice every week that we called TTT, and it stood for Top Three Teams. And it was once a week, I would have my top three debate teams, and they were there exclusively from 5 to 8. It meant that I could give them very focused attention. We could talk about advanced strategies. They could do some practice speeches. And kind of the trade-off was I would give them my undivided attention for those 3 hours, and they would help me with some of the younger students during the rest of the week. Well, the reason that I will remember that date forever, and so will they, isn't because there was some unique strategy talk or that they gave an incredible speech. You see, on November 30th, 2009, there was a lot of drama going on because these 6 students, who were mostly sophomores and juniors, decided that they knew more than I did about debate and who they should partner with. And so for the first 2 hours of practice, they kept coming up to me and being like, I should partner with this person. And when I would tell them, I don't think that fits, they would scream and run off to the next room and slam a door. There was all kinds of bickering going on between them. And so after about 2 hours, I called them all around my desk and I sat them down and I said this. I said, look, I'm the coach, and you need to stop the drama right effing now. I am confident that if someone had lit a match in Marshfield, it would have immediately been extinguished because I sucked all the oxygen out of the city. And as those students kind of slinked away from my desk, I knew that I had made my point. You see, I'm not someone who cusses, ever. Not because I have anything against it, just because I don't find it to be terribly efficient. And that day, I knew that my students would always remember that date, and so would I. Not only because that was the only time in all of my teaching career that I ever cussed at a student, but it was also my 30th birthday. And every year on my birthday, I get a text from at least one of them that reminds me that it's the anniversary of when I scared them more than I ever have. Now, amazingly, I didn't get called down to the principal's office. No one disciplined me or anything like that. And I think it's because, shockingly, high school students had heard that word before. What? Shocking. But it wasn't harming them. They and just knew that I was frustrated with them, and they weren't going to call me out for some social norm or some like theological reason. You know, I think it's funny that even though Jesus often talks about how we are to come to God like children, that children aren't the ones often who try to reinforce social norms and social mores, and yet the church collectively often spends so much time kicking people out because they're a little rough around the edges, because they cuss a little, or because they don't fit the social norms and the social mores. Pastor Philip shared one such story with me this week. It's about a Baptist minister and civil rights activist named Will Campbell, who can be seen in, not this picture, that's not Will Campbell, but this picture. He is the gentleman on the left. This was right after MLK's assassination. And here's what they said about Will Campbell, that he was a balding, funny-looking, hard-living preacher, a Baptist-bred drinking buddy and spiritual advisor who had emerged over the years as a Socratic Southern gadfly, a thorn in the flesh of conventional wisdom. One of the ways that Campbell was such a thorn in the flesh, or disrupted the conventional wisdom so much, is that he had a unique ability to distill down what was actually important and what were just social norms. The civil rights era was an exceptional space where this was happening, where people were saying, like, what's actually really important? And one of the best examples of this was while he was out promoting one of the books that he had written, and he was on a television call-in show, and a lady called in and asked him what his opinion was, or if he could explain the fact that one of his good friends, musician Charlie Daniels, would often use what she called bad language when he was on television. Campbell thought about the bad words that might have been said and said this, "I don't know, ma'am. Can you tell me what he said?" To which she replied, "Well, no, I can't repeat those words on television." And so Campbell offered, "Well, what if I said the words out loud, and when I say the word that was so problematic, you just say, that's it." And she agreed, and so he started. And he said, "Ma'am, did he say prejudice?" "Well, no." "Well, what about war?" "Nuclear bomb?" "No, he didn't say any of those." And then he said something so profound. He said this, "If I don't know what he said, and you can't tell me, then I can't very well express what I think about it. And those, the words like prejudice, war, and nuclear bomb, those are the worst words that I can think of." It seems that we are still struggling with this notion of what is actually important and what is not. Just even this week, I read stories of places where people were protesting public school libraries because they were allowing students to read books that had words like gay or trans in them, but would support the mandatory reading of books that included the glorification of war and violence. It's almost as if we were born without bodies, but with weapons. And it's not just gender issues that we read about, right? It's also race. Dr. Babb, who's a psychologist, said it this way, "Talking about race and racism is an uncomfortable and often emotional experience. It's understandable to have a fear about being seen as a bad person or being part of the problem. However, this is a problem when the fear of being perceived as hated and socially unacceptable becomes worse than the thing itself, i.e., when being called a racist is seen as worse than the actual racism." As we're trying to struggle through this space, not only about the things that we say in church, but even the things that we say in society, it brings up the question, how do we know what's okay to say and when to say it and what's not? You see, when I was growing up, this answer was really easy. I was raised that you should never, ever cuss, right? Not in public, not at school, surely not at church. In fact, there was this old Baptist phrase that would go something like this, "Don't drink, cuss, smoke, or chew, or go with girls who do." And American megachurch pastor who has resigned from there named Francis Chan once described American churchgoers this way. He said, "It's crazy if you think about it. The God of the universe, the creator of nitrogen and pine needles, of galaxies and E minor, loves us with a radical, unconditional, self-sacrificing love. And what's our typical response? We go to church, sing songs, and try not to cuss." I often wonder if these ideas are not just random platitudes. They are social mores and norms based on our culture. They're not actually a part of what it looks like to live and love like Jesus did. I mean, my parents would have definitely phrased it as, look, you need to take care of the temple, right? Present yourself clean to the King of the universe. But I'm not so sure that that's what Jesus was talking about. So today, what I'd like to do is I'd like us to spend about 15 minutes looking at a story that shows up in the Christian New Testament, in the book of Matthew, chapter 15, where Jesus talks about the things that come into our mouth and the things that go out of our mouth, and how those things can be evaluated. If we start in verse 1, it says this: "Then some Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem." Now, before we go any further, I do want to mention that when it says things like teachers and Pharisees of the law from Jerusalem, what it's talking about is like the highest of those, the ones who were considered the most powerful. Jerusalem was the seat of power at the time. And so it says that they asked him, "Why don't your followers obey the unwritten laws which have been handed down to us? They don't wash their hands before they eat." And Jesus answered, "And why do you refuse to obey God's command so that you can follow your own teachings?" It's a pretty good comeback. Now, you may be wondering what in the world hand washing has to do with cussing. Let me, before we go any further, say this. This is not a hygiene question. If you go to the bathroom, WWJD, wash your hands, right? Please. But really, it has much more to do with how we handle tradition and niceties compared to how we practice living and loving each other in this world that we exist in together. Douglas Hare, who's a professor at Pittsburgh Seminary, said it this way: "Jesus' approach to the problem is legally radical. This is a matter of tradition, not law," he insists, "because it is tradition alone that establishes priorities when two laws collide. Exalting the merely legal over the truly moral is sheer hypocrisy," Jesus claims, "because it professes allegiance to God's law while disregarding God's will." One of the criticisms we often hear here at the venues is that we're not following the Bible. And I would say this: at the end of the day, we are not Biblians. We are people who follow Jesus and the way of love that he teaches. In other words, the religious folks of the day here were getting all upset about whether or not the followers of Jesus were following an unwritten rule that they had made up and reinterpreted, a comfort piece for them. Not they were getting upset about the fact that the followers of Jesus weren't living into love. This was something that was super hard for me to understand growing up. In fact, it's something I couldn't even really wrap my head around until my wife and I moved to the country of Morocco. And granted, Morocco and Israel are very different countries, but they are both part of the greater Middle East, okay? And in Morocco, there are these neighborhoods all around. And in these neighborhoods, there are basically four rules that aren't really written, but they have to be followed. In every neighborhood, there are four things. There has to be a mosque that can be walked to so that people can go worship, because that's really important. There has to be a bakery so that they can get fresh bread. There has to be something called a hanut, which is basically like your little convenience store. It doesn't have like gas or anything like that, but you could get your basic necessities for the day. And then the final thing was that every little neighborhood had to have a fountain, because it was important in Islam that before you go pray to Allah, that you are ritually clean. So remember, Morocco is where the Sahara Desert starts. So they'd be dusty. and they would want to present themselves as fully clean. Many of the religious leaders and law keepers at the time of Jesus would have been experiencing this in the same way. They were going to the followers of Jesus and to Jesus and saying, why aren't they keeping these things that make us feel comfortable? We don't like it when people show up in temple and aren't clean. It doesn't feel good to us. Even if they looked at what we now call the Old Testament, the first five books, the Pentateuch, there were multitudes of instructions about how you would wash yourself if you came in contact with a dead animal or if you had an infection. And these weren't necessarily bad things, right? They helped with hygiene, but the problem came when they became so focused on making sure that no one broke the smallest aspect that they weren't looking at the people who were doing it, saying, I love you where you are. So the first thing that I think is really important that we pull out of this is this. We need to rethink our language. Let me say this again. We need to rethink our language. Let me be very clear here. There were no cuss words that we say today that Jesus talked about. Why? Because Jesus didn't speak English. He wasn't white. He didn't have blonde hair or blue eyes. And he didn't speak English. He spoke Hebrew and Aramaic. In fact, just to kind of drive this point home a little bit further, he couldn't have been upset about the F word because the F letter didn't exist until the 1400s. So literally, Jesus couldn't have given an F about it. So if that's the case, why is it that when we see words like this, fire truck, we think it's perfectly fine? In fact, I am sure that right now there are people back in kids' venue right now telling the kids about how awesome fire trucks are, right? You use the tools that you have to care for those who are hurting. It's a great lesson. It's super important. And we would have no problem at all if they put those letters together and said, this is a fire truck. But if you take the letters out of there that also happen to spell the word retire, suddenly it's a problem, right? And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a good word to use. There is a lot of violence that comes with that word, and we'll talk about that here in a second. But honestly, most of the words that we consider problematic today aren't problematic to what Jesus was talking about. In fact, most of them are merely talking about bodily functions. Things that because we have bodies, we do, right? I remember that when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to say the word fart. I'm sure if my parents are watching right now, they're like, oh my gosh. Yeah. And so I remember at church, there were a lot of other kids who weren't allowed to say that as well. So they would say other words, right? Like poot or toot. There was even one, there was even one kid who called it turtling. Turtle. It was wild. I think that it's those types of random rules and that type of a society that was being created, that's exactly what the teachers of the law were talking about and what Jesus was spending his time critiquing here. You see, the Pharisees were so concerned about like social norms and feeling comfortable in polite society that they were missing the bigger picture. And it caused them to get frustrated. Actually, Matthew 15:12 says this, then Jesus' followers came to him and said, do you know that the Pharisees are angry because of what you said? Let me be very honest with you. As a white cis straight dude, a lot of society is built for me to be very comfortable, right? I mean, laws, most of them, written by white cis straight dudes, right? Written to privilege people who look and sound like me. Things like religion, most religious norms, written by white cis straight dudes, most of them had beards too. They make me comfortable. And it's not only serious things, it's also unserious things if you think about it, like clothing. If you ever go into a department store where clothes are laid out by men's and women's, one thing you'll notice very quickly is that if you go to the clothes that are labeled men's, they have pockets, right? They have pockets. In fact, I even have a pocket in my shirt. and they're deep enough to put my hands in them, they're amazing. But if you go over to what they call the women's section, there aren't pockets. And I'd like to say that this was just a simple oversight or something like that, but I don't know if it is. In fact, just recently, there was this excellent article written by Chelsea G. Summers that said this. It said, pockets are more than sexist. They're political. You see, women's pockets were a private space carried into public with increasing freedom. And during a revolutionary time, this freedom was very, very frightening. The less women could carry, the less freedom they had. Take away pockets happily hidden under garments, and you limit women's ability to navigate public spaces, to carry seditious or merely amorous writing, or to travel unaccompanied. You see, clothing is supposed to be for everyone. It's supposed to guard you from the elements, to protect you from the outside. And yet, when people who were probably white cis straight dudes thought, women are going out by themselves, we can't handle that, they took them away. You know, I think that there is something that needs to be said here, and that is this, that when people who have had all of the systems built for them start seeing equality for other people, they start to feel like it's oppression, and it's not. It's not oppression when other people get other equal rights. It's not a pie. Someone else getting more rights doesn't mean you get less. Everyone can be equal. Everyone can have pockets. And I know that's a really radical thing to say. But maybe it's the issue that the people who have always been comfortable keep focusing on the wrong things. People who look like me and sound like me keep focusing on the things that keep me comfortable instead of the things that other people actually need. And so today, when we're talking about cussing, I want us to actually reframe what we're saying. And I want us to think about the fact that maybe Jesus wasn't as concerned with cussing as he was with cursing. And maybe it's not as much about social norms as it is about social good. So what's the difference? In verses 17 through 20, Jesus does a really good job of explaining this difference. He says this, "Surely you know that all the food that enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then goes out the body. But what people say with their mouths comes from the way they think. These are the things that make people unclean. Out of the mind comes evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual sin, stealing, lying, and speaking evil of others. These things make people unclean. Eating with unwashed hands does not make them unclean." And so here's the second thing that I want you to pull out of this, is this. We choose to tell people what we think about them by how we speak to them. We choose to tell people what we think about them by how we speak to them. Notice what Jesus does say here are the problems with certain words, right? He says, out of the mind comes evil thoughts. Murder, adultery, sexual sin, stealing, lying, and speaking evil of others. The word that is used here, and by the way, remember that when this text was originally written in Greek, they didn't have things like commas. It's really possible that this entire list is a list of things that come out of evil thoughts. And this phrase that is used for evil thoughts, it's the only time in Scripture where it is used, and it's this Greek word. It's dialogismus. Dialogismus. And it's where we get our word dialogue, but what it really means is a series of thoughts that are calculated to reinforce the beliefs that we already have. It's sort of like the dialogue that you have by yourself when you're in an argument with your partner and they aren't there, right? You're constantly, I'm going to say this, and then they're going to say this, and then I'm going to say this, and then they're going to say this. And you have that discussion. That's exactly what Jesus was saying here, is that we keep having these thoughts where we are the only one there, so we are constantly putting ourselves higher than the other person. If you look at the list, if you think of the list again, talking about stealing, what you're saying there is what I want is more important than what you want. When we say lying, saying that my truth is more important than your truth. And even the things that it talked about here, like adultery and sexual sins, don't think about them like the current context. Remember, at the time, women were considered property, right? And so for this to happen, what it was literally saying is not consent, but I'm going to take you and own you. Yeah, that's bad. It is bad when we constantly are thinking through things that put ourselves at a higher level than other people. So maybe, and I could be wrong here, but maybe when Jesus was talking about the words that we say, he was much less concerned with the letter formulations that we use and much more concerned with the ways that we say those words to the others around us. One of my absolute dearest friends and closest mentors says this to me pretty regularly. He says, I just need you to tell me like you love me, even in conflict. And I'll be honest, you may disagree with everything I said, and that's fine. You can text in, and we'll try to answer your questions later about it. I don't care what you say. You can disagree. You can come at me with it. But just tell me like you love me. Just tell me like you love me. James, by the way, says almost the exact same thing when he writes this. The human tongue is physically small, but what a tremendous effect it can boast of. A whole forest can be set ablaze by a tiny spark of fire, and the tongue is as dangerous as any fire with vast potentialities for evil. It can poison the whole body. It can make the whole of life a blazing hell. Our words have huge potentials, right? They can explain things. They can comfort people. But they can also confuse things and cause people to feel like they are less than human. And maybe, at least when I was growing up, one of the ways that this was most often used was talking about taking the Lord's name in vain, right? I was oftentimes told that that was the same thing as cussing, right? That the worst thing you could ever do was say the GD phrase. And so we created alternatives, right? We would say, oh gosh, gosh darn, golly jeepers. The style of Christian cussing that was okay on television in the 60s. I actually saw a sign not too long ago that said it this way. It said that heck is where people go who don't believe in gosh. So maybe, though, maybe there's something about using God's name to promote dominance, though, instead of just worrying about the letters that we happen to formulate together. As this tweet says, I can't believe that I grew up thinking that using God's name in vain was saying, oh my God, and not using God to manipulate people or advance your own personal agenda. Yeah. How often do we do that, right? What if it means, and like I said, I could be way wrong here, but what if it means when we say that God has a particular political party that God is in favor of, Republican or Democrat, right? That God is in favor of that, and we use God's name to say God would obviously vote this way. What if it's about insisting that we use he, him pronouns for God? Because like I said, religious thoughts were mostly based by white, cis, straight dudes with beards. And so what if it's just about asserting our dominance? What if it's about saying that God favors one country over another, as if the children who are dying on the other side of the world matter less to God than the children here? Or what about if it's the personal examples where people say things like, God told me that you were supposed to date me. Yeah. Or maybe significantly worse, when people look at someone who's going through a hard situation, who have faced abuse, and maybe even at the hands of their abusers are told things like, this is all a part of God's plan. How insidious. How insidious. What makes us think those things to begin with? I would posit. And like I said, I may be way wrong here. I think it's because we want to put ourselves higher than those around us. At the end of Dr. Hale's analysis of Matthew 15, he writes this. And I think that this is a pretty good prayer, honestly, for us this morning. Here's what he said. He said, "Blessed is the congregation whose members treat different opinions and different practices with respect and abstain from verbal attacks. We are defiled," Jesus tells us, "by the unloving words that spring so readily from our mouths." So I wonder, what is it that we can't say in church? It might also be the same things that we shouldn't say to each other. Probably doesn't have anything to do with the formulation of certain letters next to each other, and a whole lot more with telling each other like we love them. So today, here's what I want you to do. I want today, April 14th, to be a date that you remember, because it's a date that you decided that you would start telling everyone around them like you love them, when there's good times or when there's conflict.